Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy. Jimmy Crane.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we are sponsored by the Lincoln Lodge in Chicago. Now, do you live in Chicago and you want to learn the fundamentals of creating a stand-up comedy routine? Well, the Lincoln Lodge has created a beginner's foundation course that strives to give prospective performers the confidence and skills they need to get started in stand-up comedy or just have fun trying a new experience. Go to learnfunny.com to learn more and register for this incredibly fun-filled five-week class your host Jimmy Crane did, and Jimmy Crane had a great time doing it. For more information, go to learnfunny.com. Also, for more information about my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy Level 2 Guts, where we focus on two-person scene work, go to my website, jimmycrane.com. Classes start November 4th and are limited to 12 people. See why Chicago Magazine voted my classes the top five comedy classes in Chicago. Go to my website, jimmycrane.com. And don't forget to check out my book, Improv Therapy, How to Get Out of Your Own Way to Become an Even Better Improviser. It's only $3.99. It's a really short read. You can get it on Amazon.com or you can get it on my website, JimmyCarain.com. Here we go, another episode of Improv Nerd. We've got another great, great episode. But you know what? Think about it. Just think about it for just a second. When was the last time we had a real clunker? We didn't. And if we did, I don't want to hear about it. I think they're all great. And this one is no exception because we have put together a compilation episode for you. And I want to thank everybody who's given us great feedback and some really cool ideas for future compilation episodes. And this episode is about rejection. Now, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you know there's certain things I like to talk about. Shame, low self-esteem, rejection. Not only people's rejection, but how they deal with it and overcome it. Because anybody who's great at improv has dealt with their fair share of rejection. So in this episode, we've compiled some of our past guests, our favorite moments as they talk about rejection. Sit back, relax, and I hope you're inspired by this one. Here it is, the rejection episode. Enjoy. I think Timmy Mays' story of rejection is an amazing story. He was put on an IO Chicago Herald team, and then he was kicked off. And he loved it so much, and he wanted to do it so much that he decides he's going to go back and repeat the program from the beginning.
And so you go through the program at IO.
I did, yeah.
And then you get on a Herald team, mm-hmm. and like most people, because I studied at IO, most people get kicked, you know, get their team gets broken up. Your team gets broken up. You get on a team after mm-hmm. being at IO. Then what do you do after that?
Well, my team got broken up, and I didn't get asked to come back. And I remember I was devastated, and I had to find out.
What does devastation mean for you? I mean, do you get depressed?
I was very sad about it, but I had to also find out from, like, the guy on the team that no one liked. And he, like, called me at work. He's like, oh, we got broken up. Sucks you didn't get on a team. Bye. I was like, what?
Did he get on a team?
Oh, God, no. Okay. No one liked this guy. I don't even remember his name. I just remember it was the guy no one liked. Oh, no, I do remember his name. His names are not important.
Is he still improvising?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't know. He might be. Who knows? I know he doesn't
listen. So he gives you the call, and then what do you do?
I was devastated. I remember I felt like all the work I put in that I wasn't good enough. And I remember first of all, my improv, I was just not good.
What does not good mean? Give me an example.
I was too witty. I was way too. I thought it was almost like too jokey, too witty, too jokey. I would like put an idea out and then I'd back off from the idea, and I was afraid to explore it. I just I didn't I needed more experience on how to just do two-person scenes better and delve into it more and work at it. So I remember I emailed all of my teachers and I emailed all my coaches and I said that I wanted the most honest feedback. You will not hurt my feelings.
This is really brave. How did you come up with that idea? Because I would have just, that would be it, you know? How'd you come up with that?
I wanted to get better. I really did. I wanted to just get, I knew I was decent at it, but I wanted to get much better at it.
So why not, like most people get kicked off at IO or whatever, they'll go, oh, I'm going to go to Second City or I'm going to go mm-hmm. to Annoyance. How did you decide I'm going to go back to the training center at IO and repeat it?
Well, after I got feedback, which was amazing, and I still to this day, I still have those emails.
What kind of feedback did you get?
Oh, it was brutally honest. I love it. I loved it. It was just like, this is what you don't do. The things I was saying before, they're like, you're not committing enough. You're too premise-y or you're too jokey. You're too witty. That's going to run out. You need to do this. You need to make it about a character choice. Make it about your scene partner. Delve deeper. Don't be afraid. All of these things. I still will look at them if I ever feel hesitant about something. I'll go back and I'll reread them. And then after that, when I got the notes, I was like, great, I need to work on this. So I did Barprov. I did Barprov for like 3 years straight. I would do it probably 3-4 times a week. I didn't care where.
Short form, long form, or just
all long form? Okay. All long form. And I did it in every place that don't even exist anymore. And I didn't care. I love it. I still love doing it. I don't do it as much as I used to, but I every once in a while, if someone's like, hey, would you want to come do a set? I'm always like, yes.
So then you go back to IO Training Center. You pay the money, right?
Yep. And started right over level one again. Went all the way.
And what was different this time than the first time you did it?
I had much more fun, and I was more freed up and open to like wanting to learn everything.
Had you put too much pressure on yourself the first time?
Yes.
And what was the pressure about?
I think I looked at it as like a joke contest, when that's not what improv, it's not a race, you know, it's not who can be the funniest. It's not like you got to do a joke a minute. There's much more to it. I didn't look at the artistic side of it. I looked at just the joke aspect side of it.
The creator of the TV show Community, Dan Harmon, explains to us how he got fired from a television show that he created. Incidentally, he did get the show back. But what I find so fascinating about this interview is that Dan was very self-reflective on how he got fired in the first place.
Is that why you think you were fired?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. All right. I think that I was too in control of whether or not the show happened or not, on schedule and on budget, and too unpredictable in terms of what I would want and when I would want it.
So give me an example of what kind of stuff you were fighting with the network.
Well, I'd never really fought with them. Okay. I mean, it wasn't like the fights. If anyone talks about me fighting with the network and studio, what they're really talking about is me not returning their calls. They're talking about
passive aggressive.
Yeah. For me, it wasn't passive aggressive. I was just busy. Okay. I considered my job to make a good TV show. There were 7 executive producers on the show. It was a hard won honor for me to be able to be the guy that was actually running the show creatively, and that was a full-time job and then some. So why couldn't 6 other EPs, you know, be the ones to answer the phone if Sony wanted to say, why don't you put Martin Short in it and do a Three Amigos parody? Those are the kind of calls they would make, you know. We have an idea, we want to do this, we saw the last episode, we think it's skewing too dark, we you know, like all that stuff that you're, you know, like, why can't someone else take those calls and just tell me? You know, Sony doesn't like the show. Big deal. I can write that on a post-it note. I'm busy. So I you know, that we didn't fight. But then I think in between each season, I would have this little powwow with the studio, and they'd go, how come you don't call? You know, like, we should be friends, the studio. And I'd go, well, you know, you guys said this about this episode, you said that about that episode. It's like, we're clearly not on the same page. If you want to fire me, fire me. Like, but until you do, like, I consider consider my job to make this really good TV show. And my goal is not to make it unmarketable. My goal is to make as many people as I possibly can happy. So since that represents money to you guys, we are on the same page. It's just a question of whether or not you think I'm doing it right or not. And once you think I'm doing it wrong, get rid of me. Replace me.
But it's interesting because you come from an improv background, so I would imagine you are way open to collaboration.
Yes.
When does that, I'm done collaborating with...
When you try collaborating with uncollaborative people who are not actually improvising with you. Collaboration is two ways. So if you collaborate with a fire hydrant, you're not going to get anything done. Because the fire hydrant is not gonna, depending on how you interpret what a fire hydrant is suggesting to you, you're either gonna be doing nothing or you're gonna be spraying water and the street's gonna get wet and nothing's gonna go anywhere. Now, if you bring up an audience volunteer from the audience during a show and you go, what's your name? My name's Maggie. Maggie, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a veterinarian. Okay, we're gonna do a scene about a veterinarian. Now, so look at that as like a studio executive. So studio executive reads your script and you go, what'd you think of the script? Well, I don't know if I liked it. Well, what didn't you like about it? Well, I like the dog on page one. I wish the dog was on page seven, page 12, and it made another appearance at the end of the script. I really like that. You think the dog should be like a major character in the show? Yeah, I do. Now I can work with that. I can go home and I can improvise. I can pride myself on that craftsmanship and go, Ken from Studio Global Pan wants the dog. He really likes that dog. And I'm gonna, like a loving mother making a cake that's the right flavor. I'm gonna, there's no wrong way. It's still cake. Like, what do they like? He likes the dog. I can handle that. What I can't handle is people saying, the show, like things like Sony would say, you keep doing Halloween episodes. Yeah. Every time you do a Halloween episode, you establish that another year has passed. Yeah. So the characters are getting older. Yeah. And so eventually they're going to, graduate from community college? Yeah. Well, we don't like that. Okay. We're 3 years into the show and now you don't like that? Now you want to shift gears and you want to turn into Welcome Back Cotter or Scrubs. You want to freeze time. Yeah. Okay. Taken. Note taken. I'm going out to my car now. I'm going to drive back to my office and I'm going to keep doing my show. And that note's not going to get addressed because it's too late. And that's not improv. That's a fire hydrant. Like that's a rock. That's toxic. If you when you, you want to change the title of the show, you want to change the characters. It's too late. The characters are growing. Improvise with me, collaborate with me, but don't walk onto stage and say you're not a king. You're a janitor. This isn't a restaurant. This is a bathhouse. It's, we wouldn't accept that from a sixth grade improv workshop.
The thing I like about Dana Curcioli's story is she talks about getting fired from Second City, Cleveland, and how that rejection prompted her to move to Chicago, where since she's moved to Chicago, she's become very successful.
So you guys are like really good friends. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple reviews, both you and Colleen get fired. They like get rid of six of the eight members of the cast.
Right? Yeah, we got shit canned.
Yeah. You say that like flippantly, but what happened?
It's such a long, long story. Looking back on it, I don't think the production was handled very well on the producer's end of it. And I think there was some kind of venom in the cast, like a couple people were sleeping together that shouldn't have been and whatever. And so that kind of poisoned the rest of the experience. And I know that of the original eight of us, six were let go. And, it is what it is. And looking back, I don't think anybody was the best version of themselves. So I think that's the most diplomatic way I can say it. Like nobody was... I do not include Colleen and I in this. We were perfect. But I don't think... I think the people that were causing the problems weren't the best versions of themselves. And so everybody kind of went down in flames.
Are the people that caused the problems, are they still in the, still improvising and stuff?
Some of them.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so that happens, and so when you get fired, how do you feel about that? I mean, because
my God, I was devastated. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even go back and get our stuff. Colleen had to do it, and that was like the best instance of her taking care of me in such a great friend way, because I was like, I can't go back in there. And she was like, I'll go. And, like, just took it on the chin. I mean, she was just as devastated as I was. We love that place. We used to get to works early and watch old reviews backstage in the green room.
Like on videotapes.
Yeah. And we just loved it. I mean, to us, it was like, we had to work with our best friend. We had to do this job. We get to improvise every night. People come. The theater was, like, built for us. It was, like, brand new. So I think it was a little Field of Dreams-ish for the two of us. So we were devastated. But, you know, whatever, you bounce back.
And at that point, are you like, oh, that's it, I'm never going to work at Second City again?
No. I made a pact with Colleen. Like an idiot. But if I never had done this, I wouldn't be here.
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't be dead.
But right.
hold on.
So you make this pact with Colleen.
Yeah. So we made a pact because we saw that things were kind of going sour with everybody else. So we were like, if anything happens, we'll move to Chicago. And we shook on it. And of course, I was like so blissfully ignorant that I was like, this will never happen.
Right.
So as soon as we got let go, the first thing I said was like, oh shit, I have to move to Chicago now. Because we shook on it.
Susan Messing, who is a legendary performer and teacher here in Chicago, recaps her hilarious SNL audition. And she explains to us why her personality turned off the show's producers and why she thinks she didn't get the job.
The Brady Bunch. But Miss Vagina Pageant was the show that got you an audition for Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
And then you and what, five of the cast members?
No. Well, actually, ultimately, going to New York, it was just Melanie and Betty and I.
Okay. What happened? You were so close.
Well, what happened was I found out... 2 years after the audition, I found out what really happened.
Okay.
But I can tell you what happened at the audition.
Okay, and then I'll tell you what the rumor on the street was.
Well, I can tell you what the rumor on the street was, because I know I just found out, unfortunately, 2 years after, when I could have used it.
Okay.
Because everything is a grow, you know, it's good to grow. No big deal. I remember going to New York. There were nine women that they had called across the country. This was in 1990. They called nine women from across the country, three of us from the Annoyance, from the Miss Vagina Pageant. And by the way, Quincy Jones and Lorne Michaels came to see the Miss Vagina Pageant one night, and that's how they kind of picked us. But you have to understand, I was playing a woman in blackface. women of, because I played Miss New York, I was an imposter. Women of color with Aryan features are winning these things. So I did a, you know, Harriet Tubman, and, you know.
But you had a very thick,
thick New York accent. I was obviously a Jew in black makeup.
Right.
Because that's not legal and not okay. eyeballs. Anyway, but everybody kept looking that night at Quincy Jones to see if it was okay to laugh at me. So that night's pageant turned into a pageant, like a real pageant. And when I got to New York, I was in the dressing room. They had us going into hair and makeup based on what number we were to go on, you know, on stage and do our audition. I was supposedly number 8. And then Lauren switched me to number 2, and I don't know why, so they had to rush me through that.
I don't like it.
I don't know. Meanwhile,
Nike tone.
Yeah, really. Meanwhile, Victoria Jackson... You want to call me crazy? Jesus. So Victoria Jackson comes into the room and she said, "So what do you guys have to do for your audition?" Or something like that. And I said we have to do five different characters. And she said, "Oh, all I had to do was a handstand on a desk." And I'm thinking, fuck you. You know, that's funny. So the woman who went before me was a beautiful, statuesque blonde from L.A. And really, after about 20 seconds, they get what you're driving at. She's decided to sing New York, New York as Liza Minnelli, the entire song. And then she just went delicately into a corner to pick out earrings for her next character. It took forever, her audition. After her audition, Lauren stood up and had a temper tantrum and said he was going to stop the entire audition if the thing wasn't sped up. I was number 2. So I don't remember it very much except that it went fast. But Carol Rosenthal, who goes out with Faith Soloway, was auditioning as well. And the entire audition, by the way, they said it would be a closed audition. There were 75 people at least in the room. People were bringing their cousins to watch, like, us get killed by the lions at the Coliseum. I mean, it was crazy. Oh, we were also on short, on the TV monitors all through the building of 30 Rock. It was crazy. But I got through it, and I remember thinking the audition itself was fine. What I found out 2 years later was that they were worried I would be a chatty Kathy on the set. That's what I found out from a friend who was on the show.
Okay, this is what I heard in the rumor mill.
Okay.
That you had met with Lorne, okay, which is typical if you're if you're being considered.
Right.
He will then...
We went on a walk.
Okay.
Lorne likes
and that you, you talked your way out of the job.
Not really.
Okay.
Because he wouldn't have... He had a meeting with people, and then he sent them to New York. He met with Kate Flannery and somebody else as well, and then didn't send them to New York. So if I had talked myself out of it, I wouldn't have gotten to New York. Meeting with Lorne didn't happen after New York. It happened before New York. No.
Okay.
No.
That was
but they were worried I'd be a chatty Kathy on the set. Plus, no offense, I was really immature. I mean, I've done everything ass backwards in my life.
The thing I love about Dave Koechner is he is so persistent. He's not going to let anything get in his way, even when he got fired from Saturday Night Live. And in this clip, he tells us how he kept trucking despite that setback.
And this was the first time you were back there since you had been fired in 1995. What was that experience like?
My contract wasn't renewed. I wasn't fired.
Okay. How did you look at that? How did you look at that? Did you look at being fired, or did you look at that as your contract not
being renewed? No, I looked at it for what it was. I knew it was a lot of politics that didn't involve me.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with my abilities or talent, or because I'd had a very successful season,
mm-hmm.
and it was one executive in Los Angeles who had more power than that particular season than he'd had before,
mm-hmm.
and he decided to do that. Lorne wanted to keep me.
Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, Lorne didn't want me to go,
mm-hmm.
but he had bosses to answer to,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't. The show had dipped in ratings, and this was the first year for Mad TV and for Howard Stern's late night show, and they wanted changes, and that was just the way it was. That was politics. It was nothing to do with my ability or my performance that season or anything else. And I knew all that, and I had a great meeting with Lorne, you know, and he told me all this stuff. He didn't want me to go, but so that's just the way it went. So I understood that. It hurt like hell, but, you know.
How did you get over that, Dave?
A lot of drinking. Oh, that's just time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, move on. And, you know, I got work right away, so you just keep going.
Well, the thing I was impressed was you were like, I'm going right to L.A.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you didn't let this get you down.
Hang out in New York and feel sorry for myself. Like, the work's out here. There's a lot less work in New York than there is in L.A.
A lot of people have this misconception that if they don't make a Herald team at the UCB or the Pitt or the Magnet or IO Chicago, that they're not funny, that they're not being validated. Amy Gorelick here talks about being fired from a UCB Herald team and how she decides to use that to her advantage. And she comes through, again, some self-reflection, that she doesn't need to be on a Herald team to be considered funny.
And you get on a Herald team at the UCB, right?
Yeah.
And then quickly, right? And then you get off a Herald team.
Yeah, our whole team got disbanded.
What was that like to get it, your team being disbanded?
It was sad. I cried on the phone with our AD.
Assistant director?
The AD of the theater, Owen Burke. He let me talk for a really long time, but I just cried at my 9-to-5.
And then at this point, do you go, I want to get back on a Herald team?
No, not right away. I was kind of sitting on my sadness for a while.
And how did you overcome that sadness?
I went back and auditioned. And I was like, I'm just going to try to get back in the game.
And so you auditioned, and how many times did you audition?
Just that once. I got called back. I didn't make it. And then I just auditioned again like 3 years ago.
And what happened?
There was 9 people in the room, so I immediately assumed that I was just being called in as kind of like a, here you go. Here's a little accolade.
Is that something that you still want to do, is be on a Herald team at the UCB?
No.
How'd you get over letting go of that?
I realized that it wasn't as important as everyone makes it out to be.
What does everyone make it out to be in terms of importance?
Validation. Once they get on a team, they're funny, and they have a place to perform and a place for people to come, and they have that stamp on their resume that says, I was on a UCB Herald team, so I'm awesome, you know.
I love anybody who talks about Saturday Night Live especially the audition process. And Chris Witaski runs through the three SNL auditions, and he didn't get any of them. And he was, you know, close here and he was close there. And he actually had dinner with Lorne Michaels. And how he puts that rejection all in perspective.
Right. So you get to Saturday Night Live, ask you to audition based on what they saw here in Chicago at the showcase at I.O.
Correct.
Then you do well in the audition, and then you meet with Lorne Michaels.
Yes.
And what does Lorne Michaels say to you?
He says, we really liked your audition. And
did he say it like that, or did he say, we really liked your audition?
Well, we really enjoyed your audition. Yeah. We think you're just a little bit too young at this point, but we're going to keep you on our radar. And he talked about Malcolm Gladwell and the 10,000 hours rule. Mm-hmm. And he said, go back to Chicago and keep getting better. And then we'll see you in a little while.
So he's called you back twice now.
Three times. And I did not get hired.
What happened the last time? Which was actually, when was it?
Just 2 or 3 months ago.
Okay, so tell me what happened.
I auditioned again. I got flown out to New York.
Okay, did you do the magician character? Or?
No.
Okay, all right. What did you do for the audition?
I did an impression of my dad.
How does that go?
I set it up as when I was 13 years old, I had a sleepover one night with some of my buddies in my room, and we, around 2 in the morning, started blaring music. And right around that time, my dad burst through the door wearing his boxer shorts and a t-shirt, and this is what he said. Down! Down! Way down!
That's great.
That's it, yeah. So I did that. That got a nice laugh in the room. You know they say they don't laugh and all
right.
that shit.
That's not true.
You get laughs. It's a very quiet room, and it's the SNL studio is huge. Mm-hmm. It's like this big, you know, warehouse feeling, echoey thing, and you're performing into a vacuum. Mm-hmm. But you get laughs. You can get laughs.
So you did that, and then what celebrities did you do?
Because I did an impression of Chevy Chase hanging up a telephone.
How's that go?
He just really struggles hanging up a telephone. So my dad, I counted that as an impression. In the past, I did an impression of George Lopez when he had his talk show. I did an impression of that. The thing about this time around was there were way more people auditioning than ever before because they had all these slots to fill now. You know, Sudeikis is gone. Fred Armisen's gone. Bill Hader's gone. So they have these big slots to fill. So they auditioned like 35 people this time around. So in my head, it's that, you know, that feeling when you walk into O'Connor or TPR for an audition and you go, oh my God, this is a room full of people who look just like me.
Right.
You know?
For people in the podcast, those are two local casting agents here that we go to audition for.
Right. So also at this table was other guys who looked like me.
Right.
You know, and so that's what was going on in my head was like, fuck, that, you know, there's 30 other funny white guys who, you know.
So how'd the audition go, the third audition, the third time you did it?
I thought it went okay. I felt really good after the audition. There was one sound cue that kind of got screwed up that I, in retrospect, I'm like, fuck, maybe I shouldn't have used the sound cue, you know. I took a risk on that, and it kind of didn't pay off.
Now, do you hear anything? Do after that? Do they tell you how you did? Do you talk to your manager or agent?
Yes. So then a couple weeks go by and didn't hear anything. And then I talked to my manager, Naomi Odenkirk.
Bob's wife.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And my agent at William Morris Endeavor called me and said, we got bad news. It's not going to happen this time around. And then a couple days later, I got a very nice email from SNL.
How do you feel like when other, you know, like you're close and other people get it, you know, like this, they, a new crop of people were hired this year.
Yeah.
White guys, similar, a couple guys were similar to your type,
yep.
I'd say. How do you feel about that?
It stings, it hurts, you know, and I think too, you know, I'm such a Chicago guy that I'm rooting for Chicago people. And when all of a sudden, you know, all these guys who I don't know from LA get hired, That, I think, that's tough for me because I really want, you know, when my friend 80 got hired, it was so exciting. Yeah. And when Vanessa, Bear I was on the cruise ship with Vanessa. So when she got hired, it was like, yes, Chicago people getting hired. And so this time around, when all of a sudden it's these guys who, you know, I'm sure are great, but I don't know them. It's like, fuck you, you fucking L.A. guy. Who are you? You know? Yeah, yeah. So that's the honest reaction. But now I think, looking back on it, it's just, okay, it didn't happen.
And how do you get over that disappointment? You know?
Ecstasy.
Okay. A full tab, or do you take a full tab, or you split it up?
Full tab. Two tabs. No, I think, yeah, go ahead.
Because, I mean, you know, it's so cool to be so close, but it's also, you know, the higher you go, you know, the more, the deeper the depression can be.
For sure.
How do you move on?
For me, it was actually kind of a relief because it was this dangling carrot for the last 3 years. I mean, they kept flying me out there and they kept, you know, telling me that we really want to hire you, da-da-da-da-da. And so it was always like this thing hanging over me, you know, that when they sent me this really nice email saying, hey, we're not going to hire you right now, and we want you to come back and host sometime when you're famous and tell us to fuck off. That's what this email said. And
I never said that, Chris.
So I think getting that, I think it just felt like this relief. It was like, okay, I can move on with my life now without this thing, this dangling carrot.
Brian Stack is one of my favorite people and favorite improvisers, and he was a longtime writer on Conan O'Brien. And in this clip, Brian discusses the cancellation when Conan got The Tonight Show, and everybody thought they were going to have that job for life, and how he lost that job, and he relied on the L.A. comedy community as a support system. How have you put the whole Tonight Show fiasco in perspective?
Well, I think if something like that had happened with Late Night, I'd have been devastated, you know, because I would have missed it so much, and I love that show so much. But like I said, I wasn't really enjoying The Tonight Show very much anyway.
But you had moved from New York to L.A., and you had a family there and stuff like that, and I would imagine you're on The Tonight Show, you're like, I'm going to ride this out until I'm 75.
Well, I know. I remember Andy saying, what job's more bulletproof than this one? And he was right, you know. and it was kind of like Conan said, I'm a pretty imaginative, cynical guy, and I didn't even see this coming at all. So it was kind of but you know what? It helped a lot that there's this community of people out in LA now. Almost like it's so great to have you still here, and like Noah and some of our other old friends and Mick. But almost everyone we worked with seems to live out there now. So it helped that there was this community of people that we could kind of fall back on, and there's a real supportive environment there of everybody. It really feels like if I'm at a barbecue in L.A. these days, it feels like I'm back in Chicago because everybody's there.
I love Frank Caietti. I love his positivity. I love him as a performer. I love him as a person. And this Mad TV and Second City alum talks about why he got fired from Mad TV and how, despite his credentials, he decided he was going to take classes at the UCB.
So when you left, what did you feel like?
I knew it was hopeless.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I was contractually bound. And so I didn't know I was hopeless, but I had a really deep pit in my stomach. I'm friends with Jason Sudeikis and have known him for years. And so I went to dinner with him that night. And the night ended with, I hope I get to work with you for the next 7 years, because that's how long your contract is. And I said, yeah, that'll be really cool. I don't know if this is going to work out. And a bunch of lawyers looked at it, and it basically came down to my manager calling me and going, it's an ask out. And I'm like, what does that mean? It's like, you have to call Mad TV and say, refuse to work for them before I ever started. And as much as SNL, and I've learned this, it is the biggest career regret I have, there was a reality to the situation at Mad TV, which is the producer at the time is a guy named Dick Blasucci, who is a Second City alum, who's from Wheaton, which isn't far from where I'm from. And he is the anti-Lorne Michaels in many ways. Pretty unassuming, nice guy, and I spent some time with him as well when I was going through that process. And I just kind of thought, it was a lot of pressure, everybody in the community knew. And I told two people that I think this was a big mistake, and it was Matt Craig and my wife. And it just came to a head, and I got a call from Dick, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I look forward to come working with you. And it ended. But I'm the only person that I know that have met with producers at SNL that never auditioned. So basically what happened with SNL was they said, we can't guarantee you a position because you have a contract. So you can say no to that contract, you'll still have to audition. So I would have to say no to a yes and yes to a maybe. And I thought, that's a terrible idea. And then my manager said these words, which I kind of believe, which I totally regret, which is, all I know is you need to be on a TV show this fall. And I was like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. I need to be on a TV show, which was the dumbest thing. I lived in Old Town. I loved my job. I'd only written two shows. I would have loved to do main stage. So the worst case scenario was I just keep doing that job. But you get caught up in it. And I wanted it to end. It was like a 2-month thing where it was.
How would you have played your hand differently now that you have?
I would have said no to Mad TV. For sure. Absolutely.
And then you're on the show for 2 years, and this is what I can't, because I went back and looked at your stuff. You're on that show for 2 years, you contribute on that show, you have memorable characters, and then they fire you.
They don't renew my contract, Jimmy. Dick Blasucci got fired, and budgets were cut, and I was not the head writer's favorite.
Why weren't you the head writer's favorite?
I don't know. Because I wrote a lot of stuff by myself.
And that, for Mad TV, that was not a good thing? Because for Saturday Night Live, that would have been a great thing.
Sure. I don't know. It was a staff dominated mostly by groundlings. And I was the least senior male cast member the entire time I was there. But they've missed the boat on lots of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, they missed the boat on Simon Helberg. They fired him after 4 episodes. Andrew Daly. I mean, there's a list of really great people that they've said no to or didn't move forward. Taryn Killam, who's mm-hmm. now on SNL, was on Mad TV for, I think, a half season or something. So it was just a weird...
There was something that you had written in your blog that you had said... They wanted you to be more like Artie Lang. They wanted you to be more like Will Sasso. Yeah. Who are these like big, outrageous, heavy-set, fat guys?
Yeah.
That really isn't your...
I can do that.
But that's not all you do.
Yeah. I thought I was going to get fired after my first season because I basically said, I refuse to only be that. I'm more than that. Mm-hmm. And I got off that phone and was like, I'm getting fired today.
Well, getting back to Rachel, I think that's what happened with her. She got pigeonholed for whatever reason as the so-called, you know, ugly one or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what happens. Do they just continue to write that way? Like, if let's say you had been just the big, fat, schlub, would they have just written you like that?
Yeah. I don't mind being that. I don't have anything against playing that, but I also want to bring more to it. So I don't want to just be like sloppy guy who falls down.
Right.
Like there's other people who have done that better than I have, and that's not all that I do. So I was like, if those parts are written for me, I'll gladly play them, but I don't only want to be that.
Do you think your attitude affected being fired?
I was probably more formidable than I should have been. Mm-hmm. I was never a dick,
right.
But I was honest. Mm-hmm. And I would say things like, I would like to be integrated more into the show because when I do stuff, they turn out pretty well. But I understood. I mean, I played my fair share of cops and waiters mm-hmm. and was happy to do that. I guess that would be another thing. I was also coming off of this job, which is at Second City, you write your own material. Nobody really tells you. There's not standards and practices. There's not network. There's not all that stuff. So I was coming from a job that I had an incredible amount of control. And then one thing about television is you have none. And especially at Mad TV, which is like it's a five-headed monster as opposed to Lauren is the top of the mountain at SNL. Mm-hmm. At Mad, it was all kinds of different people. Which I didn't know going
in. How did you deal with that rejection? Because from how I looked at it, you had a really quick, you know, you did real well here in Chicago. You got on a stage fairly quickly, you mm-hmm. know. Any movie that came into Chicago you were getting, you got commercials here. Now you get Mad TV, and then after 2 years, they don't renew your contract. How'd you deal with that rejection? Because that'd be the biggest bump in your road so far.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard. I think I plugged along. I have good representation, and I felt like I had faith in them, and the fact is the first couple years were terrible. Like, I booked nothing. Nothing. I had great auditions, got really close on many things and big projects, and just didn't happen. And so that'll kind of rattle your cage. But it was all right. I mean, I made my way through it. And
how'd you not get bitter about the business?
I think it's impossible not to.
So how do you deal with that? How do you get over the bitterness? Or I think it comes ebbs and flows for me, but
I worry about the things I can control. That's it. I can't control that. That's all that. I just do what I do. It's incredibly frustrating. That's my least favorite thing about this world, is the business. But yeah.
Are you getting better at the business part, you think?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. I'm congenial. I like people. I think people like me. I think that part of my difficulty is I'm not what you... When I walk in the room, they want me to be one thing, and I'm not that. And so I...
What do they want you to be?
Super schlub. Mm-hmm. Most of the time. Which I can be, but I'm not just that. I basically audition for fat nerds or schlubs.
Okay.
Which I can be.
The other...
Do you need a fat schlub?
Then, the other thing I thought which was really cool is, because a lot of Chicago people will resist it, especially someone who has been on a stage at Second City, has been on Mad TV for a couple of years, you go to the UCB in LA and you start taking classes.
Yeah.
And anybody knows that you got to start somewhere in the beginning of the program.
Yeah.
How did you decide to do that?
Because I wanted to learn. I registered.
But do you see what I'm... The point I'm making, there's a lot of people out there that wouldn't do the same thing who had your credentials.
I think the business constantly humbles you. If you're not willing to humble yourself to say that I have more to learn and learn an approach, then you're doing it wrong. I feel like I'm not better than anybody else. I feel like I paid my dues. I got to test out of 101. Mm-hmm. You know, since I was a graduate of the IO,
right?
So
the Mad TV didn't help, and Second City didn't help. But I went to IO. Yeah.
But I think they helped. In some ways, I had a teacher say, "Why don't you just play ASCAT?" Mm-hmm. Which is like
their Armando here.
Yeah,
or, yeah.
And I was like, well, because I want to learn this, and I had studied the Herald, but I hadn't studied their approach, so I was happy to do it. I took it with a friend. It was from 3 to 6 on Mondays. We'd have dinner afterwards. It was wonderful.
Abby Jacobson and Alana Glazer of Comedy Central's Broad City discuss with us how they didn't make a UCB Herald team, and that gave them the drive. That gave them the motivation to create a web series called Broad City. We all know that Broad City now is a TV series based on that web series, and it's one of Comedy Central's biggest hits. You didn't ever make a team on UCB, right?
We were on this indie team called Secret Promise Circle together for 2 years. And at the same time, we're trying to get on the house teams.
Mm-hmm. Which is and very, we just very could competitive. Not do, it's very
could,
hard.
Yeah, and we couldn't get on. Mm-hmm. And it took... No one really on our team got on for a little while, even though they're all
Dude,
so
Tim
fucking
Tim not getting on? The guy who actually introduced
Tim
us?
Who?
Martin.
Tim Martin.
Okay.
He plays Dale in 109. In the, I don't know if you've seen it, but in the limo with the balloons, Alana.
In the TV show Paul version.
Paul redhead.
Okay.
And he's been on...
Us first.
Mm-hmm. He's now, like, been on a house team for a long time.
And he's just in commercials. He's just, like, so insanely talented at comedy and improv and just being funny. His improv skills are so good. And it was just like, listen, I'm auditioning for a team, but why isn't Tim on a team yet? You know, it really was like that.
I mean, it was really like... You know, at when you are sort of in that scene, those Herald teams are the thing.
Right.
You're very tunnel vision.
Right. People think it's the center of the earth.
And then, because we couldn't get on them, we were sort of like, I think we were both like, we're good at, like, we're funny. We know we're fucking funny. We can do this. Let's just do something. Like, fuck it. Let's just make something ourselves. And without any limitations or restrictions, let's just do our thing.
We didn't want to be, after a point, it's like, I don't want to be subject to somebody's email that tells me what to feel. You know what I mean? It was like, it felt so good to, like, look at each other and be like, let's make anything. Let's just make a thing. And to make it. And then we always say, like, sending a link to our parents was huge to
but
us.
Also,
send the link. What was
the
link
to the web series?
Okay. Instead the first of being couple like, episodes
yeah,
of the
yeah,
web series.
My show was great last night. They're like, great. You know, it's like we wanted to like show our parents and our
but
family,
also,
you know?
I mean, for years you put so much time and energy and money into this thing of trying to get on a house team, trying to get on an improv team and be successful at that. And we were like, well, if that's not our main goal anymore, we're going to put just as much, if not more, energy into our thing, because now our focus has shifted and this is like the thing.
The fucking
you know?
Thing.
This is the thing that is going to not, we weren't thinking like this, we're going to ever get a TV show
at
or
all.
Anything.
Not
it was just like,
that.
You got to make your own material to be satisfied
because
in that world.
Like
you
the
know?
Web series market is saturated these days. You know, it's become yeah. this known vehicle, whereas when we were starting, fucking lucky enough, so lucky about the timing of this all, it wasn't a big, it wasn't like web series, like not just comedians do web series. Now it's like a workout web series, you know, like if you want to be like a famous trainer or whatever, or a trainer with like a lot of clients, like it's such a vehicle now. At the end of our first web season, we met our manager, who is our manager today that you, mm-hmm. you just met before, Sam, and she was like, this could be a TV show. And we were like, a what show? And so like, that's when we got like season two, let's like make this a thing and let's write a pilot and pitch it.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I love talking about rejection. It's something we can't avoid if you want to be great at it. It's like jealousy. It's part of the process. That was pretty profound. I think I'm going to write that down. I can be pretty wise, can't I? Or I think I'm wise. I don't know how wise I am, but I do. I like it when I sound very wise. I want to thank Andrew Smith for putting this episode together. Also, I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, for more information about me, that's Jimmy Corain, the host of Improv Nerd and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, The Art of Slow Comedy, here in Chicago. Or to sign up for my improv blog, each week I'll send out a blog that will help you become a better improviser and a better person. Actually, the better person is up to you. All you need to do is go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Follow us on social media. Go to our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, follow us at improv_nerd. That's our Twitter handle. And our wonderful YouTube channel, which more people, I want more people to go and check it out, because Dan Schiffmacher shoots such great videos and puts it together so slick and so professional. That's Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. We are lucky to be part of a podcast collective, a very cool, eclectic, hilarious, innovative podcast collective called feralaudio.com. So check out the other cool, innovative, hilarious podcast on feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank our sponsor, the Lincoln Lodge in Chicago. If you want to take a stand-up class, go to learnfunny.com. I did. It made me funnier, and it made me a better stand-up. I just loved it. Learnfunny.com. And, of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Nerd is a nerd, oh yeah.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I
don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My